Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm your host, Paul Vogelzang, and this is episode number 274. As part of our Smithsonian Associates Art of Living series, we're joined today by Smithsonian Museum collectors, curators, specialists, two of Smithsonian's people who ensure the safety, proper handling, and installation of Smithsonian exhibits, but most importantly, get to collect souvenirs of death in the Division of Political History at Smithsonian's American History Museum. Now, after hearing that preamble, if you think this dreary or macabre, please keep listening. I have to tell you, dear Not Old Better audience, one of the many things I love about my relationship with Smithsonian is talking to the various experts who I get to interview. Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy are high on my list of cool interviewees. These two great people stare death in the face frequently. These two, again, Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy, once opened a drawer at the Smithsonian Museum and were met by the countenance of President William McKinley staring up at them. Of course, President McKinley, while attending a meet and greet with the public, was shot in the stomach by an anarchist and would-be assassin, Leon Czolgosz, and later died. And this was just opening a drawer, so you can imagine what else they've discovered among the artifacts of death, as they put it.
For us in the collection, it's really divided into two sections. There's the official stuff of death, and then there's the unofficial stuff of death. I like the unofficial stuff of death. And by that, I really mean things that people saved for personal reasons. Official things are prepared to be disseminated and saved, things like funeral programs. We have a lot of things from last moments of the presidents. For instance, we have the chair that George Washington was sat up in a few hours before he died. He was having trouble breathing, and they thought maybe if they sat him up, that would help. And unfortunately, he still died a few hours later. But we have the chair that he sat in, and it's always pointed out that this was the last chair that Washington sat in. We have two coffee cups that are the last cups from which presidents drank. Those are eerie to have near each other because they're both from presidents who were assassinated. One is from Lincoln and one is from McKinley. Those things are the things that speak to me the most because it was obvious that someone saved them purely for the sentimental value of what they were. In fact, the most sentimental item that we have, I think, is a pressed flower. It's a rose. It's rather small. You know, it looks like any other rose that you might have saved from a wedding or something like that. But there's a note accompanying it, and it says, this flower was taken by me from my father's breast before the casket lid was closed at his funeral. And it's from Chester Allen Arthur, the son of Chester Arthur. And it's such a personal moment, but he shared it with the nation by leaving us, you know, collectively, this flower.
That, of course, is just one of my guests today, Bethany Bemis, who, along with co-curator of Political History Division Sarah Murphy, will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates program titled Morbid Curiosity, Presidential Last Moments Preserved, October 22nd, 2018 at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C. For more information and tickets, please see our website. But please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via internet phone, Smithsonian's own Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy. Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy, it is so nice to talk to you. Welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. You know, this particular topic, as many do with the Smithsonian Associates Program, but this one really, I guess, jumped out at me. And I just love the title, Morbid Curiosity, the Presidential Last Moments. Of course, you both will be at the Smithsonian Associates Program coming up. But, you know, this title, it maybe sounds a little scary, but tell us briefly about the upcoming Smithsonian Associates presentation.
Okay, well, this is Bethany, and I will go ahead and take that one. For background, you know, Sarah and I have the best jobs in the world. I mean, a lot of people say that, but we really do. Right? We get to poke around the collections in the Division of Political History at the National Museum of American History every day. And doing that, you tend to notice patterns in the collection. And one that we noticed had to do with death, specifically with presidential death. And so looking into each of the objects, we found such interesting stories that we just had to share them with the public. And so first we put together a blog series, and now we're giving a talk just on the stuff of death in the presidential collections. Death leaves a void, literal and metaphorical. And material culture studies have shown that people try to fill that void with stuff, things that remind them of the individuals that they lost or the impermanence of life in general. And with presidents, that void stretches across time, and objects saved by individuals placed in the national collections in a way fill that void for future generations. So with this presentation, we're really just sharing the collection stories and doing our part to kind of fill in that void.
That's wonderful. Thank you. That's very helpful. Sarah, let me put this question to you. Sarah Murphy, I read that both of you literally opened a drawer at one point at the Smithsonian, and you found this death mask, of all things, of President Grant staring up at you. I guess this is kind of what I mean about scary. I suppose the Smithsonian is known for having all kinds of things, but a death mask just sounds, it just doesn't sound like something I want to open a drawer to see. So what was your initial reaction? And I guess the next question is, do all presidents following their death get a death mask?
Well, first, it really wasn't scary. It was more kind of creepy.
Because
you open
said
a
that.
Drawer and you're like, what is this? Oh my gosh, it's President Grant staring up at me. And we actually recently got a loan request that someone wanted to borrow the death mask. So people know that these things are out here. No, not every president gets a death mask. We actually only have three in the collection. The death masks we have belong to President Grant, President McKinley, and President Wilson. So the mask that belonged to Grant is one of these stories where it's a mold was made, and you can't make a mold from another mold, and this is the original plaster mold. So we have two masks that belong to Grant. Actually, one is plaster and one is bronze. And that came to us from his sons, from his children. So we have that one. And then we have a mask that belonged to McKinley. And it was taken shortly after he died up in Buffalo. So it was a New York sculptor got in contact with McKinley's secretary and asked to make this mask. And this mask is definitely creepy, because there are still pieces of McKinley's hair attached to the plaster.
Wow.
And including an eyelash on his cheek.
Wow.
So that definitely ups the creep factor.
Right.
Just a little bit. And our third death mask belonged to Woodrow Wilson. And the person that took that mask was a medical sculptor at Johns Hopkins. And he took the mask. And it was given to the, at that point, the United States National Museum by his widow in 1963. And she was like, oh, yeah, we've had this since it was taken in 1924. And I feel like it should be given to the museum now. So that's how we got those death masks. But we also have in the collection a death mask that belongs to Napoleon. Not entirely sure why we have it, but we have it. And then we have two life masks that belong to Abraham Lincoln. So we have other masks in addition to death masks.
This is really a fascinating, curiosity, I suppose, and that the title just fits. So let me just ask you just a real quick follow-up question, Sarah Murphy. And I get the impression in some of your description that maybe some of these were done artistically. Is that right?
Well, people have been making death masks since ancient times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a way to remember royalty and persons of note. And in the medieval ages, they would make a mask to create a bust or a statue of a specific person and then use that cast or that mask to also then create artistic paintings. And Victorian period, it kind of changed a little bit. The Victorians were very into morbid and really accentuating the mourning period. And turn of the century, it all started kind of fading. So we don't really do death masks anymore. So it definitely, at some points, had an artistic bent to it.
Just a fascinating subject, really. So, Bethany Bemis, to you then, what else is prepared and accumulated after a president dies? Because you made this really good point that there's this void, you know, that we want to fill. So what else do we add to that void?
Well, so for us in the collection, it's really divided into two sections. There's the official stuff of death, and then there's the unofficial stuff of death. And Sarah and I have sort of split that up as far as specialties go. So I will speak to, I like the unofficial stuff of death. and by that, I really mean things that people saved for personal reasons. Official things are prepared to be disseminated and saved, things like funeral programs, other mementos that Sarah will speak to. But people will save, much like we do with our own families, personal items that maybe don't mean anything to anyone else without the story. We have a lot of things from last moments of the presidents. For instance, we have the chair that George Washington was sat up in a few hours before he died. He was having trouble breathing, and they thought maybe if they sat him up, that would help. And unfortunately, he still died a few hours later. But we have the chair that he sat in, and it's always pointed out that this was the last chair that Washington sat in. We have two coffee cups that are the last cups from which presidents drank. Those are eerie to have near each other because they're both from presidents who were assassinated. One is from Lincoln and one is from McKinley. And we have funeral relics, things that were kept that you wouldn't expect to be saved. So we have sprigs of evergreen from the Lincoln funeral wreath, one of the wreaths. As we know, he had many. But someone saved one of the little sprigs and put it on a card, and we have it, you know, almost 100 years later. We have a piece of ivy from a Garfield funeral flower wreath. Things that we think of when we produce a funeral, but we don't think of saving necessarily. My personal favorites are just sort of the off-the-wall unique souvenirs. For instance, we have three pieces of George Washington's original coffin in our collection. His coffin was moved. The mausoleum in which he was originally buried, he had already expressed desire to have it redone at the time of his death. It didn't get done until quite a bit later, but when they went back in to move him, they found that his original coffin was deteriorating, for lack of a better word, spongy. And so they took it apart and put him in a new one, and they took bits of the old one and circulated them around the country as souvenirs. So we actually have three pieces of it, so I consider us quite lucky. But those things are the things that speak to me the most, because it was obvious that someone saved them purely for the sentimental value of what they were. In fact, the most sentimental item that we have, I think, is a pressed flower. It's a rose. It's rather small. You know, it looks like any other rose that you might have saved from a wedding or something like that. But there's a note accompanying it, and it says, this flower was taken by me from my father's breast before the casket lid was closed at his funeral. And it's from Chester Allen Arthur, the son of Chester Arthur. And it's such a personal moment, but he shared it with the nation by leaving us, you know, collectively this flower.
Very touching, very sweet. And so, Sarah Murphy, I can imagine that the list of official things could be endless, especially if a president has passed in some recent history. Where do you kind of draw the line, and what is kind of a good example of some of the official things that we might not think about?
The way we broke it up, we think of the official as like the official programs, the official ceremonies that are associated with a funeral. And that includes, like, in my subset of official, my unofficial, of especially back in the 1800s, where news traveled a little bit more slowly, they would have memorial services for presidents. So it's still part of the official record of mourning your leader, but it's not the official service for that person. So we have, for McKinley, we have a booklet of a memorial service from the Philippines that they did for him. And then we have some oratory sermon type services for presidents such as like William Henry Harrison and Zachary Taylor. So we have those things. And we also have quite a few floral arrangements that belong to the services for James Garfield. So immediately after his memorial service, they took the flowers away, waxed them, and sealed them. So we have 5 floral arrangements that are preserved from 1881. So those are pretty creepy, too, if you want creep factor.
Yeah. Of course, we want the creep factor.
Yeah, that definitely ups the creep factor right there. And then part of the official stuff is clothing, morning clothing and jewelry. So we actually have a dress that was worn by Jane Pierce. So I don't know if you know the story of Jane Pierce, but she was not a very political person. And obviously her husband was, as he was president. But shortly before they came to D.C., Jane, I'm not sure if Franklin was there or not, but Jane and the youngest son, Benny, the only ones who survived childhood, and he was still like 12 or so. There was a train accident, and he was the only fatality. So she already was prone to depression, and she just sank into a deeper depression, and she wore black the entire rest of her life. So we have the dress to remember her is a black mourning dress. And then we also have a mourning cape that belonged to Julia Grant that was worn in Washington, D.C. about 1885. And mourning is broken up into first mourning, second mourning, and ordinary mourning. So first mourning lasted no less than 1 year and 1 day. And it was flat black, nothing shiny. Second mourning, you could add a few decorations. You could start wearing some mourning jewelry such as onyx or jet. You could add a little bit of like embroidery. And then in ordinary mourning, you could start wearing some subdued colors like lavender and a little bit more jewelry. And just as a signal that you were stepping out of this mourning period. So Julia Grant's cape has some pin tucks and some decorations on to show that she was in second mourning. And some of the jewelry we have in the collection contains hair, which is also a very Victorian thing, was to keep hair of your beloved and a piece of jewelry close to you. And you could actually send the hair away or look in some magazines such as Harper's Weekly or Ladies Goaties magazine for instructions on how to do it yourself. So even back in the mid-1800s, women were still being crafty and the early versions of Pinterest, I guess.
Good. I'm glad you both have a sense of humor about this. I really am. And of course, we're with Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy. Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy will be at the Smithsonian Associates program coming up. It's actually October 22nd, so it's coming up fast. It is before Halloween. The title is Morbid Curiosity, Presidential Last Moments Preserved. Really, this is such a fascinating subject. So, Bethany, I'm gonna ask you.
Sure.
What? Yes, please. What other odd, bizarre, or even creepy things do you come across in your work?
Probably the most bizarre item in the political history collection is a preserved horse hoof. You wouldn't think so, right?
No,
but
no.
Most of us have a fondness for the horse hoof because it comes with this really kind of touching story. And it's the hoof, and it has the horseshoe attached. It's a black lacquered hoof. So, you know, when you first look at it, it kind of looks like, well, maybe it could be a sculpture or something like that. But no, it's really a preserved hoof. And it's the hoof of the horse we refer to as Valiant Little Fire Horse number 12. And the story is that in Washington, D.C., in fact, March 30th, 1890, he was part of a team pulling a horse-drawn fire wagon to answer an alarm. I believe it's at the Knickerbocker Theater. And the horse cart and one of the steam engines collided, unfortunately, on the way to this fire. And when they untangled themselves and continued racing to the fire, they got there, and the driver of the wagon with Valiant Little Fire Horse number 12 turns around and realizes that his one horse, unfortunately, is now missing his left rear foot, apparently run over and cut off in the collision or caught somehow. In any case, he ran all the way to the fire on his stump of a foot, and the firemen and people of the town were so impressed with his dedication to his work and sad that they unfortunately had to put him down, that they preserved his hoof, and it's still here many, many years later.
That's a good one. And yes, that would have to be coming from Bethany Bemis, who is on the side of the unofficial
yeah,
list.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. Well, Sarah Murphy, does the work, you know, the accumulation that you do, does it change in terms of what we accumulate when the president's assassinated? Because you've mentioned Abraham Lincoln, you've mentioned McKinley, you've mentioned Garfield, the three presidents to have been assassinated. I'm assuming it doesn't, but correct me. Does it change?
It changes, but it also doesn't change. So if and when a president is assassinated, it's more of a shock because it's the living president, not a president who is at upper, like, older age and has been ailing, and you're kind of prepared for it. As opposed to someone who is much younger and it's taken from you. So if a president is assassinated, we tend to see more souvenir-type objects, like personal mementos. For example, we have a couple of railroad spikes in the collection that belong to the train spur that was built for Garfield to get from the main train line to Elberon, New Jersey. They took him out to the seaside to get some fresh air in hopes that that would help him recover. So they built this train spur literally overnight. And then after he died, they took him back to D.C. under the same path. So people would take some of these railroad spikes as mementos and souvenirs of, I was here when this happened. And, like, for example, when Reagan died, I was at work, so I saw the funeral procession. But it was, okay, here's a procession, here are the motorcades, here are the horses, here's this. There wasn't a takeaway. So other than saying I was here, I don't have anything. I don't have a booklet. I don't have a program to say I was part of this. So that's kind of how it changes, because I didn't go to any of the official services. I didn't go to the cathedral. And we have several programs from memorial services at the cathedral. So it's the takeaway, it's the mementos, the remembering, this is what happened, I was part of this. So, like, for McKinley, he was assassinated at the Temple of Music. So people created all of these postcards as mementos for people to take away, saying, I was at this Buffalo exposition, actually, and I was here when this happened.
If I could add something, and that is that one of the other things is that when presidents are assassinated, Sarah and I have a harder time sort of separating the objects into our camps, sort of official and unofficial, because it all becomes one, in a sense. The government itself saves a lot of objects as evidence, or it has in the past. And in a way, those items that I might have thought of as personal become political and official. So for instance, one of my most favorite things in the collection, and has been since I was an intern here nigh 10 years ago, is a cuff sleeve, or a sleeve from a shirt that was worn by Dr. Leal. I have to look up his full name. But he was present when Lincoln was assassinated at Ford's Theater, and he rushed up to the box to give him aid, and some of the president's blood dripped onto his sleeve cuffs, and he saved them, as you would, for posterity. And that becomes something that feels, in one sense, personal, and yet belongs to us all officially, because it is an actual like piece of our president. So I think the lines get blurred a little bit there as to what is sort of official and what is unofficial.
Thank you for that. Bethany Bemis, Sarah Murphy, what a pleasure it is to talk to you. I really could talk to you for a long time. I have one final question, and I would imagine both of you, and especially given the two camps that you refer to, Bethany Bemis, but I wonder if you'd both maybe tell me why this is historically helpful, you know, to accumulate this as we remember our fallen leaders.
It, in a way, helps us remember that these people were human, that they were the leader of our country, they were one of the leaders of the free world, but they're still only human. They're still a husband, a brother, a father, a cousin. They're only human, and we expect so much more out of them. So I think that we develop this attachment, especially if we agree with their policies. His policies affect X, Y, and Z, and
that's a nice answer. I agree with you. I mean, it's more than just a memento. It's something that we ascribe some natural feelings about, and some of those are political, some of those are personal, some of those are just straight emotional. I think that's really true. Bethany, what do you think? Why is this historically helpful?
I think that one of the ways it's helpful is that it helps unite us today. All of these memories of personal people now represent a collective memory that tie together Americans throughout time, throughout physical space, and it gives us a collective history that we can point to and say, this is part of our national identity, this is part of our national narrative. It's something that we all can share together. Whether we agree with each individual person or not, they form, you know, the sort of the backbone of our governmental structure and the story of the United States. So I think it helps us today to identify ourselves as Americans together.
Well put. Well put, both of you. But I like that. I think that now more than ever, we need to be tied together as Americans, irrespective of policy, perhaps. But such a pleasure to talk to both of you, Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy. Of course, you'll be at the Smithsonian Associates Program coming up October 22nd. I look forward to learning more about this fascinating subject, but I've just so enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Remember, Bethany Bemis, who along with co-curator of Political History Division Sarah Murphy, will be appearing at the Smithsonian Associates program titled Morbid Curiosity, Presidential Last Moments, preserved October 22, 2018 at the Ripley Center in Washington, D.C. For more information and tickets, please see our website. Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy love their jobs, and as you heard, I loved talking to them both. I think you'll love this creepy, yet thoroughly enjoyable presentation at Smithsonian Associates. Plus, also as you heard, both Bethany and Sarah have a great sense of humor about this notion of morbidity, and that's so fun coming from a couple of history majors. Thanks to Bethany Bemis and Sarah Murphy for joining me today, and thanks to the wonderful Smithsonian team for all they do to support the show. The Not Old Better Show. Talk about better. Thanks, everybody.